Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, actors John Voight, Burt Young, and biographer Nick Dawson discuss the never-before-seen cut of Hal Ashby's film, Looking to Get Out. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome, everyone. This is going to be a great episode of Movie Geeks United this evening. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry.
And we're beside ourselves, man. I mean, this is exciting.
The day keeps getting better and better as far as the show is concerned.
I know. We just booked Mr. Burt Young earlier this afternoon to take part in this discussion tonight. So that's very special for us and for our listeners too, certainly. This is also a special show because it concerns one of our favorite filmmakers and one of the most influential filmmakers of the past 30, 40 years.
That's right.
Mr. Hal Ashby. And this is a phenomenal discovery. Mr. Ashby's cut of a film he did in the early 80s called Looking to Get Out. It is going to see its world premiere in the coming weeks. And this is going to be quite a show. Jerry, let me just ask you first. Ashby, obviously, we're big fans of 70s cinema. Ashby played a major role, was a major player in that time period. When did your consciousness of Ashby begin?
Shampoo, probably in the mid-80s is the first time I saw that in high school, and later on The Last Detail. But I have to even go, I have to actually, that's wrong, actually. You know what the first film I saw? Being there.
Yeah.
And on television in junior high in the early 80s. I take that back. Obviously, as Mr. O'Brien said, Harold and Maude, but it's really Being There and Shampoo are the earliest films I can remember watching.
Yeah, and it was probably Harold and Maude. I think, actually, they showed us Harold and Maude in high school.
You got to see that in high school?
Yes, I think so.
You never got to see that in high school.
Yeah, it's quite a movie. That was my introduction to him, and then I of course found all of his other movies. I was a huge Nicholson fan in school, and of course I looked up The Last Detail.
The Last Detail. Coming Home. I mean, you know, that's another one. You know.
Remarkable works, and we're going to be talking about some of those works throughout the evening with these great talents we have on the show with us tonight. But our focus will be on this new film that's been discovered. So let us begin. The Landlord, Harold and Maude, The Last Detail, Shampoo, Bound for Glory, Coming Home, Being There. These are just some of the landmark films directed by one of the industry's most beloved and talented filmmakers, Mr. Hal Ashby. Now, thanks largely to the efforts of biographer Nick Dawson, actor John Voight, and Ashby's daughter Lee, we can add another treasure to that incomparable roster of films more than 20 years after Mr. Ashby's death. Mr. Ashby's comedy, Looking to Get Out, starring John Voight, Burt Young, and Anne Margaret, was released to lukewarm reviews and box office receipts upon its release in 1982. But that release that they presented was a crippled, truncated version of Mr. Ashby's vision, having been overtaken and recut by the studio. But Ashby was determined to see his vision through. Prior to his death, he secretly recut the film to his own specifications and produced a print that has not been heard of or seen by the movie-going public until now. On June 30th, Warner Home Video released the new cut on DVD, but in April, The film will enjoy its world premiere at the Sarasota Film Festival as part of a larger Hal Ashby retrospective and tribute. And word has it that this could be another masterpiece in Mr. Ashby's collection of timeless films. This is an amazing story about an amazing filmmaker and the unexpected final gift he has left us all. So let's get to our first guest. And what can we say about our first guest tonight? 4 Oscar nominations for Best Actor, one of which he won for his searing performance in Ashby's Coming Home. He's one of our most revered actors with a body of work that reads like a laundry list of some of the most influential films of our time. From Midnight Cowboy to Deliverance to Coming Home to Heat, John Voight's creative fearlessness, deep compassion, and humanity have marked every one of his compelling performances. And in this conversation, Mr. Voight chats with the movie geeks about his relationship with Hal Ashby, the warmth of their cinematic collaborations, and the poetic 27-year journey that their film Looking to Get Out made before it could be shown as Mr. Ashby intended. I wanted to start by asking you, before we get into to Looking to Get Out, you had worked with Mr. Ashby previously, of course, a tremendous project, Coming Home, and I wanted you to give me a sense of what made him so unique as a filmmaker and what made his sets different from the other filmmakers you've worked with.
Well, Hal, I have to say that when I was a young actor looking for the people to continue my career, and I got, of course, with Midnight Cowboy, I burst onto the scene, but I'd been around doing work on stage for a while and some television, but all of a sudden people recognized me from this great film, and which was directed by John Schlesinger at the top of his game, and he was a very great director, and so we had this great success. And then the other people at that time, they were as actors were coming forth, like Dustin Hoffman prior to myself, just one film prior.
Yeah,
he was a phenomenon when he came forth, and you know, as it is today, you know, there's discoveries almost every year, and I was one of those with Midnight Cowboy, and then there were directors as well that were suddenly coming to the fore at that time, and one of the ones that everyone had great regard for was Hal Ashby, and you're always thinking, well, maybe I can work with Hal one day, you know, and as it turned out, you know, we would see each other every once in a while, but I never really got to know him well, but always had this great feeling about Hal. And then when we finally came down to it with Coming Home, I pursued the role that I finally did get, but they were considering me for a role that Bruce Dern finally did.
Yeah.
And so I was in discussions with Hal Ashby, with Waldo Salt, who was the writer of Midnight Cowboy as well as Coming Home, and Jerry Hellman, who was the producer of Midnight Cowboy as well as Coming Home. But this is the first time I would be working with Hal Ashby. And Hal was the most, what can I say about him? Of course, when you meet somebody that you admire, you know, there's always a little intimidation. You know, you're deeply honored to be with them. You're hoping that things go well with your collaboration, and you're looking for the ways you connect. And with Hal and I, Hal was very quiet, didn't say a whole bunch of stuff, you know, I would say, shy of a lot of attention. But he was extremely bright and full of good humor, a unique sense of humor, a little on the dark side maybe, but really was really funny, and he was a very loving man.
Yeah,
you know, he cared for everybody. He cared especially if he was very sensitive to people who were hurting, and you know, very sensitive generally. So working with Hal, as I got to know him more and more, we became collaborative and Coming Home. He would come to me with suggestions early in the morning, and I would respond with some of the things I was sitting up at night thinking about, and we'd put things together in the scenes that we shot on a daily basis. And we, because of the circumstances, a script that wasn't quite finished, we had this need to do it, but then we had the joy of doing it. I would always be happy to see Hal coming toward me, and I think that it was mutual, and we would pepper this piece with lots of ironic humor and passion.
Yeah.
So we worked. We seemed to work well together. We were, as they say in our world out here, we were good chemistry for each other. You know, we had fun working together, and when that happens, you know, it's always a good sign. And we were able to say and do things together that I think were daring sometimes, you know, and unusual always. So that's why coming home was the way it was, and it bore his, you know, his signature very, you know, very beautifully. I thought
it really did. It really, and all of his films, and all the qualities that you just described, that you found in him, the loving nature, the concern about others, and the kind of the warm heart, you can see that in his work, and it's a beautiful legacy of work. That's why it's very exciting that we're getting to see the previously unseen cut of Looking to Get Out the way that he wanted it shown. Mm-hmm. But tell me about when you first received this script, or this project came to you. What were your thoughts about it?
Which script?
Looking to Get Out.
Looking to Get Out was born of, it had a little bit of an interesting history. My brother, Chip Taylor, and he changed his name from James Wesley Voigt to Chip Taylor when he got a record contract at 16 with King Records in Harlem. He was a young singer-songwriter, and they were looking for a Rick Nelson type. And in those days, they thought about changing names. When I came along, I didn't want to change my name, and none of my peers did either. But at that time, they were still in that kind of thought that, you know, you change your name. And since they were looking for a Rick Nelson type, they wanted a Rick Nelson name, and Chip Taylor was what they came up with. So my brother had this name, and he had some success. He had a very big success with a song called Wild Thing. He wrote Wild Thing.
Wow.
And actually, his demo was what the Trogs used exactly note for note. If you played Chip's demo record, and you played back-to-back with the Trog's interpretation of it, you would see there was absolutely no difference whatsoever. So he could have had a hit on that if it had been distributed and advertised properly. But anyway, that's the way things go in the business.
Yeah.
And he had this huge hit. And anyway, we were all a close family. I have a brother that's a volcanologist who's rather world-known. And we were all three very close growing up and continue to be through our adulthood. But anyway, Chip passed me 33 pages of a script that was being written by his buddy and a buddy of mine too. His name was Al Schwartz.
Mm-hmm.
And Al was a character in our lives, a very interesting guy. Used to be a stuntman, was a Korean War veteran, gunner in B-25s, and then had this stint in the music business where he was managing different acts and stuff. He was a very interesting guy and a guy I liked very much, had a good sense of humor. I guess that's part of maybe an identifying factor in my friendships. You know, we do a lot of laughing, but he presented Al's 33 pages to me. And the 33 pages, he said, there's something to this, and I looked at it, and there was indeed some kind of signature, some originality, and something in the dialogue that was very special. And I looked at it, and the story wasn't there yet, and so I encouraged him to keep working at it. And as it turned out, I worked with him, and finally became a co-writer, really, because I would work with him on a weekly basis until it was finished. And then we couldn't get it made. And I was doing this really for Al because I thought it was I thought he should get some attention for this work. Mm. Finally, there's a story connected to this, but I at one point said, I'm going to get this thing made. I'm going to take it to my friend Hal Ashby, and Al liked it, and we set off to do it. And then we had all sorts of drama in the making of it, and in the final stages. Hal was not able to finish the film, so it was there was some damage done to the film, and it came out in a crippled form. So unfortunately, nobody ever saw the film in a proper state.
So the studio took and did their own cut of it. That was
well,
they
interceded. They said 15 minutes have to come out, and Hal walked away, and they did the 15 minutes, and it was not helpful. And then I tried to fix it, but couldn't fix it, and you know, if you take 15 minutes out of almost anything, you're going to hurt it. But
wow.
In this case, the film they had a date, and they had to make the date, and I understood their concerns, but also the damage had been done. So,
wow.
So we didn't have a happy ending to our journey until most recently, when we discovered that Hal had cut the film before his passing and had taken this cut and given it to UCLA.
Without telling anyone.
Now, there's backstory to that. You know, I understand all the motivations. I can figure it all out. But it really was like a message in a bottle sent out to sea,
yeah.
And that was it was lost until a year and a half ago, almost 2 years now, when a young Scottish writer by the name of Nick Dawson, who had fallen in love with Hal's work, and he was 26 years old, but quite a lot more mature than 26 years old would indicate.
Yeah.
And he called me up and he said, "John, I'd like to interview you. I'm doing a book on Hal Ashby. I'd like to get some of your insights." And I said, "I'd sure be delighted to talk about Hal." And then he showed up at one point, and he actually showed up. I mean, there's even another aspect to the story that's quite unique. And he said, he called me from San Francisco and said, "I'm in San Francisco." This was a couple of months after he talked to me initially. And he said, "You know, I'm up here in San Francisco. I'm coming down a couple of days." I said, "That's great." He said, "May I bring with me Hal's daughter?"
Huh.
And I said, "I didn't know he had a daughter." He said, "Well, he did have a daughter, and she was trying to get in touch with him during her lifetime. They almost met several times, but they never did meet. But it would be nice for her to hear her stories about her dad." I said, "Isn't that wonderful?" I said, "Look, I'm very sorry I didn't know about this, because I was close enough to Hal that I definitely would have been able to get them together. So let's have her come along. We'll have some fun." And indeed they came, and she turned out to be this young woman, Lee Ashby McManus. And she's an older woman, and she's now, you know, she's not a kid, and she's had a couple of children herself, and she's a terrific gal. And it would have been so nice for Hal to have had that connection, but there were reasons in his background why that would have been a difficult thing, and maybe the whole story may come out one day. But anyway, they came down and they started talking about how much they loved Looking to Get Out, and I asked Lee, I said, "Why was it?" She said, "It's my favorite film." I said, "Why is it your favorite film?" She said, "Because I think the girl in it, the little girl at the end, who was played by Angelina Jolie as a little baby, 4 years old, was me." And I thought about it, and I said, "Yes, it's very possible that it was you." So I remember the discussions we had, and we were thinking of going with a little boy, but Hal wanted it to be a girl. And so I remembered those conversations. And then Nick Dawson said, "It's one of my favorite films as well." And I said, "Well, where did you see it, Nick? Did you see it in DVDs, or what would you see?" He said, "No, I saw the cut that he left UCLA. I said, "What?" He said, "He left UCLA a version, and that's the one I saw." And when I heard that, the first question I asked him, I said, "Tell me how it begins. Can you tell me how it begins?
Yeah.
Describe the opening." Because we had several versions, and Hal had shot a lot of stuff beyond the script in the beginning, and I never thought when we were working on it that stuff applied. I thought we could have started where we started in the script, which is Alex picking up the car, but we never got a version like that. That started in the proper way, and was edited tightly and all of this. And I knew I knew cut for cut what it was, you know, each cut. That's one thing I can remember. You know, if I see, especially one of my films, I know every cut.
Yeah.
And I know what's not on the, what's on the cutting room floor as well. So I said, he described it to me, and I said, that's a new version. And then I said, well, let's go see it. So we called up right then, that day. I said, let's call up UCLA, and let's go down and take a look. So I said, let me call Al Schwartz, my buddy, and let's see, because he'd love to see it. And sure enough, you know, we went to see it, and we sat there, and I said, let's put up a reel. We put up the reel, and the kids at UCLA said, "Whoa, this is a great film. We play this every once in a while. We love this film." I said, "Is that right?" So I said, "Let's see the first reel." So we looked at the first reel, and sure enough, it was a new cut, something I hadn't seen before, and it was very well done. The first time I had seen that section as well done as it was, you know. Then I said, "Let's put up the second reel." So we put up the second reel, and sure enough, every cut was, you know, terrific. When each scene had been adjusted, too. It wasn't like I was watching. Some sequences had been in the original, but, you know, for whatever reason, the build from scene to scene was never right. You'd get thrown off here and there. This right. one just kept us going, you know. So he touched every little sequence, went back and recut, found other takes. Made strong differences in the cutting, and it all looks very natural. You would never know that it wasn't shot just exactly that way. Hmm. So I saw the two reels, and I was frightened that I would come to the third or fourth or fifth reel and the thing would fall apart. But I said, look, well, let's not spoil this because it's fragile. It's just one piece of film. It's a rough cut. It's a work print. Let's show it to Warner Brothers, who owns it now, and let's see if we can get a DVD made of this, but let's see it in that circumstance. Let's invite everybody to have a little screening. So we invited some of the Warner Brothers people. They said they'd like to see it. We invited the kids from UCLA and a couple of others. Burt Young joined us. I couldn't get in touch with Annie at that time, but my producer, Bob Schaffel, was there, and we sat and we saw it, and we saw it reel for reel, every reel held up right through to the end credits, and it was just wonderful for me to see this creation of ours. And so Al was overjoyed, Bert was overjoyed, I was overjoyed, and everybody in the room was happy with the film. So it was an exciting moment for us all. And then then immediately Warner Brothers said, we're going to release a DVD on this. So that became... And by the way, Nick Dawson was there, and Lee McManus. Lee Ashby McManus was there as well. So we had a wonderful, you know, it was a real celebration. And then Nick called me a couple of weeks ago, actually, and said, you know, he's going to have this. He's got the Sarasota Film Festival, so we arranged for them to have a copy of the DVD, the first copy. They'll be showing it in the theater. I don't think they'll show the film. I think they've cleaned up the DVD, so we'll have a projected DVD, I think. Now, maybe
it's
the
high
film...
Def. It's a high-definition transfer,
DVD.
I believe, yeah.
Uh-huh. So it'll be a very nice piece, you know, and it'll be the first time. It's a premiere.
First time. That's amazing. So tell me about this journey. It seems like you've come full circle. So many have come full circle with this process.
Yeah.
It's almost poetic in a way. What has this meant to you, this
whole
journey?
Well, it's a big deal for me because of many reasons. But one is that this film, which was not received well, will have its proper place in Hal's legacy.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful. It is a Hal Ashby film. It's a very, very good Hal Ashby film. This will take its place now, and for me too. I like this film very, very much. And it's one of those films. it's a comedy, obviously, you know, and at the base, and it's got a lot of other stuff in it as well, but it has some thrilling stuff and very extraordinary stuff filmically and in the acting department, and there's stuff that I've been, that's kind of classic stuff within this film, see?
Yeah.
So I have a feeling that people will be walking around saying some of the words from this film, because the language is very vivid and fun, and also, you know, it fulfills my legacy as well.
Yeah.
So it becomes a portrait that I can be very proud of.
Well, as a film,
and
lover,
I think the same thing is same thing is true of Anne, and the same thing is true of Burt Young. Certainly, Burt Young is wonderful in this piece.
He is terrific. Let me tell you, as a film lover, the project feels like a real gift to me. So
nice of you to say that. That's
I cannot
great.
Wait, and I hope to meet with you during premiere night.
Yeah, great, Jamie.
Mr. Voight, I really appreciate your time. I'm a great admirer of yours, and I appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you, Jamie. It's been
Thank
my pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. That's our conversation with Mr. John Voight about this very special, unique project. And he's just a darling gentleman, Mr. Voight.
Oh, he sounds great interview.
Great actor, a very big-hearted man. This doesn't happen very often. I mean, this is a very special event.
Mm-hmm.
One of cinema's great directors, and a previously unheard of cut of one of his films. We're rediscovering or discovering for the first time his vision
right.
of looking to get out. This is, like I said to him, this is enough to make me salivate. It's a big event for movie fans.
I
want to welcome everyone to the show. If you're listening on our homepage, or if you're listening on a different server or a different page, one of our players, we do have a chat room. You can log into our chat room by visiting our homepage site at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited. There's lots of film fans in there, and you can submit questions for our guests and converse with other film fans in that chat room. And if you have a question for any of our remaining guests, you can dial in 718-508-9477. And at the top of the hour, we'll be speaking to another terrific actor, Mr. Burt Young. And that's very, very thrilling for us, too. So, But let's get to our next guest. I'm really looking forward to discussing this project with our next guest. Nick Dawson is editor at filminfocus.com, and he writes a weekly interview column, The Director Interviews, for Filmmaker Magazine. His entertaining and insightful cinematic musings have also graced the pages of Empire, Uncut, The London Times, and The Scotsman. In his new book, Being Hal Ashby, Life of a Hollywood Rebel, Mr. Dawson lovingly traces Ashby's life and his unique, tender, and thought-provoking legacy of films. You can purchase the book yourself from our homepage. If you click on the front cover icon there at the top of the page, it'll take you directly to the place where you can purchase it, and I highly recommend it. It's a phenomenal book about a phenomenal artist. Of that book, Peter Biskind raves, "Finally, a book, and a very good one indeed, on Hal Ashby, the neglected, least appreciated director of the 70s, Hopefully, Dawson's excellent volume will revive Ashby's reputation and get him the attention he deserves." It is a great pleasure to welcome Nick Dawson to Movie Geeks United. Mr. Dawson, hello.
Hey, how are you, Jamie?
Hey, Mr. Dawson, how are you? Thank you so much for being with us.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
I love this book, and I love that there is finally Mr. Biskind expressed, finally a volume that pays tribute to this remarkable filmmaker. But tell me a little bit about you and when your love for film started and what role Ashby played in that for you.
Well, my love for film goes back about 20 years, just to when I was a little kid and I don't know, for me it's a little embarrassing to admit, but my love for film sprang out of watching sort of movies like The Wizard of Oz, and that led to a sort of rather unusual obsession with Judy Garland that it's probably best not to get into humor.
That's fine.
My wife always gets a bit uncomfortable when I talk about that because it sort of presents, it's something of a cliche to be obsessed with Judy Garland as a kid, but I'm not sure if I quite fulfill that cliche ultimately. But it's weird because the Ashby, I came to become interested in Ashby not so much from initially from a love of his films. It was more I read Peter Biskin's book Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, and I love the book. I think it's a phenomenal portrait of the new Hollywood generation, and I really became fascinated with Ashby's story, or such as it is in the book, and I really was intrigued to find out more. And that was really my entry point into the whole Ashby experience.
Yeah. So when you read the book, and obviously you began to investigate Ashby's films, what about those films struck you, and Ashby's particular voice? What were you taken by?
I think there's a real... one of the things that people say about Ashby is that, Andrew Sarris in particular, he said once something like, how Ashby intrigues me. He couldn't really piece together he couldn't create a straight line through Ashby's movies. At the time anyway, people struggled to fit him into the Otero puzzle, but I think there's a real interesting dialogue that runs through them about sort of there's a lot of men in his movies looking for something that they ultimately can't find, and if you know his story, then that makes a little bit of sense. I don't think it was a conscious thing, but I think he was drawn to stories like that. And he has a real sort of idiosyncratic voice and a sort of slyly political, very sort of subtext rather than text, but he had a great sense of humor. There's a real warmth to his movies as well. When you're talking about him bringing to the screen a writer like Robert Towne, who sort of typically is not the most sort of emotional of writers in terms of the warmth of his character. So he's just got a very rich, just a really fantastic, rich body of work. And it was really exciting for me to come to that as somebody who, in a way, viewed it through his life as a lens rather than just viewing the films in isolation.
Yeah. Well, speaking of his body of work, all of the films are extremely compassionate and like we've mentioned before, very warm. Even when he tackles taboo subjects,
right.
With coming home, the paraplegic sex he deals with, he deals with the Vietnam War very early, and ageism with Harold and Maude, with a much older woman and a much younger man. But all of the perspectives are very tender and compassionate. And that speaks to the man too, from what I've heard from Mr. Voigt.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was really an incredibly compassionate person, and he didn't like to judge his characters. When he was, I think it was working with Robert Towne was a real challenge for him, because he said at one point, I don't like these people. I wouldn't want to spend time with them, but I would never judge them. So, and that's really the approach that he brought to his films. He really always tried to find something to like in everybody, and to find the common thread between his experiences and their experiences. He was never afraid to tackle the big subjects, because that sort of humanistic aspect allowed them to become that much more accessible to people. And I think he also was sort of mischievous and playful, and the idea of tackling those taboo subjects was kind of very appealing to him. There was once a project that he wanted to make about this guy who basically sort of picked prominent members of society whose political views he disagreed with and sort of picked them off one by one. And it's an incredibly edgy script.
Uh-huh.
He never would have got it made in a million years, but it was a pet project of his for sort of 3 or 4 years that he just had on the back burner that he wanted to get made. And that was sort of a testament to you know, he was really very, very sort of forward thinking, and a friend of his once said that, you know, he was sort of about 2 or 3 years ahead of the zeitgeist. And I think looking back at his movies from the 70s, they still feel very, very fresh. And
yeah,
I think that's a sign of just how true that statement is.
Especially being there, that was way ahead of its time and still relevant to today.
Yeah,
it sure
absolutely
is. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, there was. It's funny, at the time that it came out, within a couple of months, it came out in late 79, and just a few months after that, Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan were both trying to use it as political capital against each other.
Right, right.
And, you know, sort of 20, 25 years on, during the middle of George W. Bush's presidency, it was once again had a certain prescience, if you
mm-hmm.
like.
Yeah, it did.
Tell me a little bit about, in your research, I understand that Hal had a very troubled upbringing, and I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that and how you think that played a role in his point of view as a filmmaker.
Sure. His parents divorced when he was about 6 years old, and his father committed suicide when he was 12 years old. And there were kind of, well, there's a lot of controversy surrounding that. If you speak to members of his family, they will say that it was an accidental death. But based on reporting from the time, it seems very likely that it was a suicide. And, you know, according to some people, Hal was the person to discover the body. That's, in a way, it's kind of irrelevant whether that was not the case, because that was the story that he told sometimes. So whether or not he was the first person, it clearly had a massive and incredibly traumatic impact on him. And I think if you were to look at the impact of his father's death, it really, particularly at an age like that, when, you know, most teenagers are already sort of somewhat confused by the world and trying to find their place in it, and if you suddenly lose a parent, it's the kind of thing that can have a massively detrimental effect. And I think Ashby had a lot of issues with both authority and abandonment that really, really played a massive role in sort of throughout his life, and particularly in his dealings with women in the case of abandonment and in the authority issues with studios. I mean, he really struggled to adhere to the wishes of studio bosses and producers, and had an incredibly antagonistic relationship with them in almost all cases. And that, during the latter stages of his career, that really became a big issue. And, you know, looking back on his career, a lot of people talk about the significance of drugs. The ironic thing about that is that the producers and the studio executives that he antagonized were the people who spread, you know, or encouraged stories of his drug use as a reason to blacklist him, not literally, but sort of bring down his reputation. And so those are the stories that remain ultimately as the more dominant, whereas actually I think if you look dispassionately at his life story, you could kind of say that he pissed off all the wrong people.
Yeah.
You know, rather than he took drugs.
And really, you spoke of your first exposure to him, which was in the Easy Rider's Raging Bulls. He is a dominant figure in that book, and really, from that group of 70s filmmakers, really the most tragic in a way. And he has been kind of maligned with the drug abuse talk. But all you need to do is watch his films, and you get such a sense of who he really was. It's remarkable. And I'm wondering, when you took on this book, what was the process? What was the journey? How long did it take you? And what were the highlights of that journey for you?
It's been a very interesting journey. I probably started thinking about it seriously in about the latter stages of 2002. Mm. So it's probably been about, it was about 5 or 6 years in the making, and a lot of that time was simply research. I began working on the book when I was still living in the UK, and it was a very sort of slow and difficult process because of all the materials and all the people that I wanted to have access to were about between 3,000 and 5,000 miles away. So that was a little problematic, but in terms of the highlights, I had a fantastic time researching the book in LA for a number of months, and in the process met my wife. Who was working at the library where I was doing most of my research. So that counts as a definite highlight. I think I get no dinner tonight unless I mention that.
Yeah, if she's listening, you're in trouble if you don't mention that. Yeah.
Yeah. She's probably going to download it, even if she's not listening. So. But no, it's been incredibly fun. And one of the things that was most remarkable about this was I was basically, you know, somebody in my early 20s living in Scotland who nobody in the film community had any knowledge of at all, really. I mean, I was a film reviewer for Empire, as you mentioned at the top of the segment, but really there was literally no name recognition. However, Ashley's name was this remarkable catalyst in opening doors, and it was just really amazing to see the number of people that, you know, people like John who talked to me when really they just trusted that because I was writing a book about Hal Ashby that I was somebody who it was worthwhile for them to share their stories with, and that's been one of the really a remarkable thread that has run through the whole process of writing this book.
I am stricken by that too, because it seems that everyone that collaborated with him, everyone that knew him, couldn't help but fall in love with Ashby.
Yeah,
yeah. And what was the common thread in terms of Ashby as a creative collaborator? What did his collaborators appreciate most about him in the working environment?
Well, I think he was somebody who was really. It's kind of a cliche now, but one that's seldom true in a way, bizarrely. But he was really all about the work. He was completely egoless, and so many people that I've spoken to would really literally talk about the fact that he would listen to ideas from a grip just as readily as he would from, you know, the DP or one of the actors or the screenwriter. He was literally like, if you had an idea and you were on the set, you know, any idea was one that he was willing to listen to, and he was truly, truly collaborative, and he you know, any idea that was going to help the film was one that he was willing to get on board with. In the case of the film like Coming Home, that resulted in basically the actors doing a huge amount of work improvising to help with the script, because they began filming without a script, and similarly on 8 Million Ways to Die, with less happy results, because the film that was ultimately released was not one that he was involved with creatively in the editing. He was fired beforehand. So I mean, there were, he really trusted everybody that he worked with completely. And in the cases where he was allowed to follow through, the results were remarkable. If you look at the director's cut of Looking to Get Out, that's a really it's a great example of his creative vision followed through to its logical conclusion. Because you look at the version that we have of the film at the moment, and you compare it to the one that is going to be released in a month or so, and they're really night and day. The changes are not necessarily that great, but the impact that they have is quite incredible.
Yeah, let's talk about Looking to Get Out now. Did you come across it in your research that he had made this cut and given it to UCLA? Was that the first you heard about it?
Right. I one of the guys that I contacted during my research was somebody called Dan Salik, and he'd actually seen a cut of the film in the mid-'80s when there'd kind of been these sort of below-the-radar screenings of the film in the hope of having it released. I think it was about 1986, and that release never happened, sadly, but there were kind of whispers kind of going around LA at that time that something might be happening. And so he told me about this, and so I kind of had my eyes open for something, and when I was going to the UCLA Film Archive, I looked at their catalog of Ashby movies and noticed that the number of reels that they had for Looking to get out was slightly, I think it was, they had 7 reels rather than 6 or something, it was something like that. And so I take a look at that one, and it turned out to be this other version.
Wow. And why do you think he did that? Obviously he was unhappy with what the studio did to his, how they recut it. And he had his own vision that he wanted to protect. But why didn't he share it with anyone, and why did he give it privately to UCLA, do you think?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think he reached a stage in the 80s when he lost some of his fight, basically. His dealings with Lorimar, the production company that he had a 3-picture deal with, that ended very, very badly, and this was the final picture of those three. And I think that there was a part of him that just didn't want to have any more conflict regarding that relationship or that film. It had been in post-production for almost 2 years, and that's pretty much unprecedented, you know, at any stage.
Yeah.
It had been very, very troubled film, both in the shooting and in post, and I think he basically trusted that somebody would find it, and that, you know, eventually, you know, what has happened would happen, that somebody would find it and that it would get out into the world and that his version would be seen. But as I said before, he was really incredibly egoless. You know, he'd done it. He'd finished the film. It existed, and that was, at the time, I think that was probably enough for him.
Yeah. Having seen it, I'm sure, several times, what can you tell us about it, and where do you think it stands in his canon?
Well, I think the really easy division that has been made in Ashby's life is to say that the 70s were the time when he made good movies and the 80s were the time that he made bad movies. You know, that almost works as a theory, except that this new version of Looking to Get Out sort of throws a spanner in the works. And I think it ranks along with the movies that he made in the 70s, which are all, in my opinion, just really fantastic films. In terms of the differences between the version that we have and this one, there are a number of really fantastic and sort of idiosyncratic scenes and sequences that are are in this film and that aren't in the previous version that really add an incredible sort of character and individuality to this version. And also another really, really important distinction is the pacing and the rhythm of the film, because the existing cut that we have was cut to try and be like a more conventional studio movie, to be a sort of, you know, they tried to make it more of a comedy than it was in the cutting and more fast paced, and there's a much looser feel to this and a much more laid back and natural rhythm to this, which is,
yeah,
is just wonderful. And it's one of those things that it's difficult to quite work out how he did that.
Mm.
But it is.
Yeah, it can be a kind of elusive, and it's amazing that they trimmed, in effect, something like 15 minutes from the film.
Yeah.
And in restoring that footage and putting his own kind of slant on a new cut, does it? You've mentioned this previously, just touched upon a little bit, but does it feel like a different film altogether when you compare it to the older version?
I think it's a little bit. It's a little bit like Houses, in the sense that you can say that all the bricks are pretty much the same, but you can make a lot of different shapes with it. There's a lot of very, very similar components and aspects, but, you know, Ashby was the great master builder, and he hadn't quite finished the house in the first place, and somebody else finished it, and that's really the difference, is that this is a film that really is totally his.
Yeah. And so with the Sarasota Film Festival upcoming, it's going to enjoy its world premiere, and it also is accompanied by a tribute to Mr. Ashby and a retrospective. But are you moderating that tribute?
I will be involved, yes. I think I'll be sort of talking to a number of the sort of friends and colleagues of Ashby who will be there to pay tribute to him.
Fantastic. And I believe it's Mr. Voigt, Norman Jewison, who we didn't even touch upon this, that Ashby actually started in the business as an editor, an Academy Award-winning editor for In the Heat of the Night, correct?
Yeah.
That's incredible. And Ileana Douglas, who is Melvin Douglas's, was it granddaughter?
That's right, yeah. She visited him during the filming.
Of being there, yeah.
Yeah,
and,
so that'll be very interesting.
And his daughter, Lee. And tell me a little bit about that story here. Was he aware that he had a child and that she was trying to find him, do you think?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there's a letter that he wrote. Well, just to give it a little context, he got married at the age of 18, and had a daughter, but left when she was still under 1 year old, and this was sort of in the late 40s. He went off ultimately to Los Angeles, and eventually got involved in the film industry. It wasn't a direct transition. And during the early 60s, he wrote to his mother, and there's a very poignant letter that he wrote to her talking about his relationship with his daughter, because they never had any contact that she remembers. Obviously, she was just months old when they were last sort of physically together. And he said, you know, I will meet with Lee when everything is right. It's a very easy thing to say that you'll do something when everything is right, but in our lives, in anybody's life, seldom is everything right, and that was really the case. Is that as time went on, the idea of meeting the daughter that you abandoned is never an easy proposition. But to constantly put it off makes it all the more difficult. And he, you know, he was aware that she would write letters, and he was aware that she would call, but he never quite got over his fear of how he would deal with that.
Yeah. Yeah. But how is she today? Obviously, she's an older woman, and her relationship with her dad has to be quite similar to ours, which is through his films.
Right. I mean, she grew up as somebody whose only communication, if you like, or communing with her father was through his films. So she would always go and see the latest Hal Ashby movie when it hit the theaters, you know, through the 70s and the 80s. And, you know, her mother and some other family members, you know, gave her, you know, told her as much as they could, but the a strange and sort of rather, on a personal level, great aspect of writing this book was that I was able to allow her to get an insight into her father that she never had through talking to her about him and sharing with her the stuff that I had learned through researching the book.
Mm. It's a remarkable story, and your book on Mr. Ashby is remarkable as well. The book is Being Hal Ashby, Life of a Hollywood Rebel. And Mr. Dawson, I look forward to meeting you at the festival, and I also look forward to bringing you back on in the coming months when we conduct our all-encompassing Hal Ashby tribute, reviewing his entire career. That would be a great pleasure for us.
Well, thank you. I look forward to doing that with you also.
Thank you so much, and thanks for the lovely book, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That's Nick Dawson, the book Being Hal Ashby, Life of a Hollywood Rebel. Jerry, if you can look on Amazon and post up a link in our chat room.
Sure, sure.
I thought we had the link on our homepage.
Okay, yeah, I'll do that.
I'll get that up, but for right now on the chat room. But definitely look up this book, and it's a wonderful portrait of a wonderful artist and a very important one. Movie fans, if you haven't discovered the films of Hal Ashby, you need to. They're some of the most extraordinary works I've ever seen, and I'm honored to be speaking with his collaborators tonight. And speaking of which, our final guest is on the line.
Let's bring him on.
Yeah, this is really thrilling for us. Our final guest of the evening is an accomplished author, screenwriter, playwright, a highly acclaimed artist, and one of our finest character actors. Burt Young has well over 100 credits on film and television, including unforgettable portrayals and terrific pictures like Chinatown. Let's stop right there.
Yeah, I mean...
Chinatown. Ah, this is a dream. The Killer Elite, Back to School, Last Exit to Brooklyn, and She's So Lovely. But perhaps his most... Yeah, great, great. But perhaps his most memorable and beloved role was as Pauly in the phenomenally successful Rocky films. Mr. Young infuses each role with a rare and touching combination of strength and vulnerability. Quite simply, he's one of the best, and we're very pleased to have him with us tonight to discuss his extraordinary accomplishments and his role opposite John Voight in Mr. Ashby's never-before-released cut of Lookin' to Get Out. It is a tremendous honor to welcome to our show Mr. Burt Young. Mr. Young, are you with us?
Yes, I am. And
hey, welcome.
Thank you for speaking so well.
I do the best I can. We're very honored to have you with us. You're one of our favorites, and this is a big thrill for us. Before we get into your collaboration with Mr. Ashby and this film, I just want you to tell me a little bit about how you got started and what motivated you to get started as an actor in this business. Did it seem like a faraway dream for you when you were young?
It was too corny a reality from where I had grown up. It was only when I was in my late 20s and I was chasing a girl that I got.
Isn't that always the way?
Yeah. So this is a common thread on the show that we hear. It's like that. So that's awesome.
You understand that?
Yes.
Oh yeah. But you studied with Strasberg, didn't you?
Yeah, I was. That probably was one of the luckiest things for me, that she wanted to study with him this lady, Norma, and I thought it was a girl. I didn't know who Lee Strasberg was. But I figured I can get in most places, so I found out who he was, and he received me, and I've never stopped. He gave me care and hope and justice.
Yeah, yeah. How did you take to it? What did it satisfy in you, acting? What did it do for you?
Well, up until then, you know, I had a family. I was married when I was 19. I was in the Marines very early, much earlier than that. And I was always sort of I was in every business that didn't need an inventory. Mm. And I always was on the front line. So without probably knowing that, I was pushing buttons to be where I perhaps would normally be nervous or not ready for the action. I was pushing buttons, how to be and stand tall as I could in the different situations. And so when I started with Lee, he had an ABC to root it in Stanislavski's teachings, and
mm-hmm.
it came to me very quickly.
Yeah.
I understood.
Yeah, and I think if I read this correctly, one of his comments about you, he was taken by the seemingly endless kind of well of emotions, and that's why I asked what acting did for you. I was wondering if you felt that you had all these emotions and passions, and acting was something that allowed you to direct those passions.
Well, I always had a passion and hunger and hurt, like all of us.
Mm-hmm.
But by being fairly tough, I covered over much of it to such a degree that I almost lost the ability to communicate from
right.
brain to mouth. And he saw a very tense guy that amazed him. And he wished to use that to open up sort of the well, and all I could do was nod yes, and I never stopped nodding yes.
Well, that's great for us too. Now you started in films around the time that Mr. Ashby directed his first, around 1970. He directed The Landlord, and that's around the time you broke in movies, I believe. When did your consciousness and knowledge of Ashby begin, and what were your thoughts on his work?
I went to a screening of with John Voight of Being There.
Oh.
And I had seen I don't know which came first. Was it Harold and Claude?
Harold and Maude came first.
Harold
yeah,
Maude.
They came first, yeah.
I saw that without knowing how. And mm-hmm. I was amazed at the love affair of this charming woman and this kid.
Yeah.
It was amazing to pull it off in such a way. But I didn't know how. And I really wasn't a movie guy
mm-hmm.
until I sat down in the same room with Hal. And if you would believe it, they were showing me his worth as a director. I already had the part in Looking to Get Out. And so Being There was just an extra bonus for me. Well,
yeah.
I just could hardly talk to him after watching that.
Yeah, and so how did you already got the part in Looking to Get Out at that time? Tell me about the script and your reaction to it when you first read it.
Well, it wasn't mainly it was John Voight. I knew him, of course, as an important actor and a decent type of guy. But I didn't know him personally. But I was working on MGM, a lot of MGM, on a movie of my own that I had written. And he walked across, and he walked straight at me. And he said, "Hey, hi, I'm John Voight." I said, "Yeah, how are you?" He says, I need an actor. I wrote this movie, co-wrote this movie. I need an actor that can blow me off the stage to make it work. he said, would you work with me? I said, yeah. And that's how I was hired.
Wow. Well, that's quite a pitch, right?
That
there.
Is.
I need you to blow me off the screen. Yeah.
As soon as I got out of UCI, I told everybody I could find. Would you believe this shit?
That's great. But you've worked with some of the best directors. Looking at your resume, and I'm wondering, what for you made Hal unique?
He was truly, truly unique. He was a flower boy. He was from the days of the flower people.
Yeah.
He was gentle and soft. Do you know that he used to roommate with Sammy Davis?
No kidding.
No
really?
One knows. No. It was when Sammy couldn't get rooms in Vegas in those era, that time frame. But he was the gentlest, sweetest man. When he saw, one day I remember I was drinking. I came in hungover. My eyes probably looked purple. He looked, he thought, he said, Bert, do you want to go home? Do you want to go home? Are you okay? I said, nah, I'm okay. But he really was concerned about my welfare. Not about the picture, not about the time loss. He just was concerned for me. And that's how he was throughout the movie.
Mm. You know, I think something that echoes what you just said, I heard a conversation with Mr. Voight where he talked about they were filming Coming Home, and they kept flubbing part of a scene, and Voight was getting very frustrated. And Ashby just looked at him and said, don't get frustrated. This is enjoyable. We're making a movie. We're having fun. You know? What a wonderful attitude to have.
That is.
He did have that, and he was soft as butter, and he had eyes that saw beyond. He was a true writer, director, filmmaker.
Yeah.
And he cared for everybody on the set. I never saw a crossword addressed to anybody. It could be the caterer, could be anybody. I never saw him cross.
It sounds like when you talk about how directors get the performances that they want from their actors, some are very good at directing by not directing, and it sounds like Mr. Ashby was somebody that you just wanted to give your best to. Was that his directing style?
I think you said it pretty well. He was behind the camera, and he was like a warm cheerleader that he was rooting for you and all the participants. He was rooting for you.
Yeah.
And I think he guided and shaped us perhaps many times with us not knowing.
Yeah.
He was a very intelligent man.
So years later,
but it didn't take that much to guide me. but he was a very intelligent man.
And years later, a few years ago, do you receive a call from Mr. Voight about this unseen cut of Looking to Get Out?
Yeah, I hear from that pain in the ass every 3 or 4 years. Yeah. We truly care for each other.
Yeah.
But if I saw more than every second year, I'd be in shock. I run into him in Rome. He was playing the Pope. I had to run into him. There he is, dressed like the Pope, this Protestant guy. I think he's Jewish now. He's playing the Pope with all makeup on and everything. So I got a blessing from him. And it was good to see him. And then a year later, he called and told me about this cut that he found very thoughtfully done and showing more of all of our abilities.
Yeah.
And so
you traveled and you actually watched that cut with him for the first time, didn't you?
Yes.
Tell me about that and your reaction to what you saw.
Well, it was a thing of beauty. You see, what happened with that thing, probably John knows much more, because John co-produced the project.
Mm-hmm.
But Hal was a master editor before directing, I believe. And when the movie went over budget, the studio was upset, cross, and perhaps close to being broke. And they released Hal for the editing.
Mm.
And so his greatest strength was removed from him and from us and from the public. And he evidently did this editing on his own to leave what he felt the movie should be and should finally look like, and was discovered by this youthful author that was writing about Hal and brought them to John's attention.
Did it feel to you like a different movie than the original cut? And did it feel unmistakably like an Ashby movie, finally?
Not different. More the characters were more round. You had people out there rather than flat surfaces.
Yeah.
Was I clear?
No. That was A+, my friend.
Can I tell you a funny, not a funny, a story?
Yeah,
of course.
Please.
About how he had been sick for a little while.
Yeah.
At the end, he wasn't working, and he never was a pushing type of man. I think he worked with a rock group to do something that was quite brilliant, but he wasn't doing any movies at the end of his life, and he was sick, and nothing was working, and he was brought home to his place in Malibu, and his friends were trying everything, crystals and candles and everything, and this might sound like a self-aggrandizement for me, but it wasn't. I don't mean it that way. But I went out to see him, and he was looking shaggy, you know, his beard was shaggy. He had on disheveled, you know, like the farmer's overalls with the straps around his shoulder. And he was laying in bed, and I laid down next to him. And I asked him, is he scared, you know? He says, yeah, Bert. And I just laid there with him for about 20 minutes. Not much I could say. And I went home, and honestly, I had a dream in the morning. And Hal was sparkling clean and shaved and in bright new overalls. And he was beaming like the sunshine. And they called me about 10 in the morning, told me he died.
Oh.
And that's a fact.
Wow. His what do you think his legacy is for moviegoers that are just coming into his films? What do you hope they take from Ashby and his work?
Well, I'd say complex literature done clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How's that sound?
That sounds very
that
good.
That sounds good to me.
I think that sounds good to me, too.
Hang on. I'm going to write that down. I'm going to use that.
Okay.
Before I let you go, I would be remiss not to ask you about the two things, actually. One is about, obviously, the Rocky series that you've been a part of that's been such a great part of everyone's life. My question,
hot stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it isn't. I have to say, I never know when that kid's going to quit. hot stuff. Really.
I'm wondering with the latest film. Just watching the film, it felt kind of like a full circle experience. Did it feel that way when you're doing it? It's somewhat profound in a way for you.
Well, first it was 17 years after the last one,
mm-hmm.
Rocky V, which mm-hmm. to me was a clinker.
Yeah, you won't hear any disagreement there, okay.
Yeah, I was sore. In fact, he and I didn't talk because I was sore with what we didn't do to help that movie.
Mm-hmm.
I was sore to both of us, all of us. So we really didn't talk for years and years and years until they told me he had written another story. One was turned down, and the other was turned down again, but he believed in it.
Yeah.
And my daughter reminded me, my daughter, now close to 40, she grew up with the Rocky things.
Mm.
And she was reminding me how we used to work together, write together, rehearse together, and the joy we used to have out of each other working. And so I went to, I was invited as a part of the audience to, when he was doing that Contender series,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
with Sugar Ray Leonard and himself. And it was the first time we said hello in many years. And he said, "Bert, I've been turned down on this, but I only want to hear what you have to say about it." So he sent me a copy, and it was magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
I says, "Sylvester, we must do it. We just must do it. It's got all the purity. You got the youth and the strength of the first." I said, "We're going to do it. We have to do it." And we started work, and he made it happen. He carried the whole ball, really. He directed. I think he even drove the trucks. I'm not sure. He was completely unstoppable. It was one of the privileges I had working with the guy that just did not sleep at all in any task.
He is a force of nature.
Yeah,
he really is. Jerry, you wanted to ask about one of Mr. Young's films.
Well, there are a lot. I mean, there's so many great films to choose from, Mr. Young. But I will ask you this, because a couple years ago, Rodney Dangerfield passed away. And I want to know, what was the experience like working with him on Back to School?
Well, you know, I took... I didn't know Rodney, but he made me laugh like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
before ever meeting him. And I took the part. It was a pretty small part, and it wasn't thinking that way. But I took it really to know him,
mm-hmm.
because I thought he was really a pissy, you know. And but at the beginning, we got off to a wrong start. He was sort of abrupt at one of the college boys outside the Wisconsin College over there. And so, for a while, I borrowed him from my trailer for poor conduct and deportment, I told him. See, my trailer was always a meeting place where the Teamsters, everybody, when I wasn't doing heavy sensual work, there would be salami and provolone and cheese and wine. And so if you barred from my trailer, you really were hurting. But then he became, and I recognized that he had, as funny as he was, he had a lot of fright and fear in himself. And I was perhaps hasty, and we became friends.
Yeah. Be remarkable.
Yeah.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you one question about your art. And we're going to put up the website on our show here. You are a remarkable artist. Your website is BertYoungArtAndFilm.com. Just magnificent work. When did this start for you, and what do you enjoy about that process?
Well, I'm really good.
That's the most awesome thing. Yeah, there you go.
And modest. That's what I love about it.
No, dude, it's beautiful. I love it.
And very modest. And, the thing is, I've always painted, but to different degrees of passion. You know, again, like the acting, it was very far removed to think of a painter's life or an artist's life. But I've always had my finger in it. I had come from a family of real talented people. My papa was a wonderful painter, sculptor, and it grew. My brother and myself, we both grew with those instincts. But life takes over in other areas sometimes. I had children young. I had the Marines younger. You know, so things, you have to put bread on the table sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been mushrooming and enjoying, and I've been getting accepted by real ritzy people.
Mm.
And that's nice. I might even wear a tuxedo soon.
It is beautiful, beautiful work. Mr. Young, let me just tell you, we're crazy about you on this show, and a lot of your films mean the world to us, and we welcome you back anytime you'd
mm-hmm.
like to come back.
Well, I thank you, and I wholeheartedly wish you great, great, grand things, and it's all out there, and we need you guys, and you make new inventions for us, okay?
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank
I appreciate
sir.
It.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good night, Bert. Thank
Good
you.
Good night. Good night, man.
All right, Bert Young, speaking about the never-before-seen Hal Ashby cut of Looking to Get Out, which enjoys its world premiere. I believe April 3rd is the date at the Sarasota Film Festival, followed on the 4th by a special tribute to Mr. Ashby. And, of course, Mr. Young spoke of other projects as well that mean a lot to all movie fans.
That's right.
What a guy.
Great. I just love it. Great guy.
We just talked to Bert Young.
John Voight in one evening, folks. You don't get that anywhere else.
This is great. I love my life tonight. It's been a great time. Jerry, if you were to recommend an Ashby film to someone that might possibly be listening to this show and they're of an age where they are just going to discover Ashby from this show. I mean, that's my hope from people.
Right. I would really honestly start with Shampoo.
Mm-hmm.
I would just because I think that's a great 70s film. And I think it's, you know, even though it's about the 70s and takes place, it's really universal, timeless almost. The themes and everything that are presented in it, and it's just got an outstanding cast. I mean, Warren Beatty, Julie Christie, Jack Warden, I mean, everyone's in it, and it's just an incredible film. Being There is good, too, Shelley, but I wouldn't start with that one. I would start with Shampoo.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about Shampoo, and you and I actually had a little conversation about this today. You mentioned the word timeless, and I think that all of his films are timeless.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, how that film deals with sexuality, promiscuity, the relationships between the sexes, and how we define ourselves by our sex appeal and how many people want us. And I'm curious because it's been maybe two or so years since I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about going back to it. I'm going to do that at the upcoming festival because they're showing all of Ashby's work and seeing what it plays like today and really paying attention to that dynamic. Because the example that I told you earlier today, if you look at a Mike Nichols Carnal Knowledge, his Closer feels like that story set in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that. Sure.
And those dynamics change.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, so I'm very curious to revisit Shampoo. Again, a very brave project, and also brave, equally brave of its star, Warren Beatty, because
mm-hmm.
let's be honest, that it feels like it could double as a commentary on his status at that time, whether it was imagined or not. I don't think it was imagined. He was one of the best-looking guys in Hollywood, and he had women that wholeheartedly subscribed to that.
yes, he did.
So it was a. It's almost along the lines of a Tootsie for Dustin Hoffman.
Right.
How they're investigating and prodding and almost making fun of a little bit the perception of them.
Right. That's a good point. Good analogy. Good film to pick.
Yeah. And Harold and Maude is jaw-droppingly good. And jaw-dropping is a good term, too, because there are many moments in this film where your jaw drops.
Oh, yeah.
This is it Bud York?
Bud Cort. Who was in, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, was in The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou a couple of years ago, the Wes Anderson film.
Yeah, and he was in Heat, too.
Yes, he was in Heat, yes.
Another film with John Voight. But Harold and Maude is terribly enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
And finally moving in the end.
Yes.
And a real testament of love between two very unlikely partners. Very free. You could tell that this was a man that, like Mr. Young said, he was a flower child.
Right.
You could tell that kind of love and unconditional acceptance carried over into his handling of his characters in these films.
Mm-hmm.
Coming Home, which was a very
for the time, very
project.
Powerful, very controversial when that came out. No doubt, that's one of the big three Vietnam films of its era.
Yeah, and one of the first out of the gate. There was actually an excellent article in Vanity Fair
about a year ago.
That film and Godfather and The Deer Hunter were off the ground at the same time. Coming Home feels like, compared to The Deer Hunter, it's very much an intimate piece.
Yes.
Exceptional performances and the characters in these roles. If you think of Mr. Voight and Bruce Dern. The casting of that, correct me if you think I'm wrong here, but you would almost think that they'd be cast the opposite way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a completely brave performance.
By today's standards, you would.
Yeah.
Especially given today, if you know them today, but back then it seemed right. Because you were, when that was really Bruce Dern in his heyday and the parts that he had played. I don't want to say typecast, but dangerously close to typecast.
Well, but Bruce
roles.
Dern too. If you think of something like, and Ashby, I think was a brave, trusting director,
mm-hmm.
and obviously he had tremendously talented people in Voight and Dern.
Oh, yeah.
They could do anything.
Right.
So my comment wasn't a criticism of that.
No, I didn't think it was.
They're both brilliant in the film,
mm-hmm.
but even something like The King of Marvin Gardens.
Which I think maybe his best performance, Bruce Dern. I think that's Bruce Dern's best performance, personally.
And Raffleson switched up the types in that movie too.
Yeah,
you would have thought that those would be cast opposite as well.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was indicative of the decade, and that's why Ashby's work fits into that decade of great filmmaking so well.
It was a very director auteur centric decade. It wasn't a focus group. Or a studio chiefs or like producers centric. I mean, the auteurs made the films that decade.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had the vision. They did it their way.
And he was one of the best.
Yeah.
And of course, being there, which was a kind of a dream project for Peter Sellers, I think it was equally as important to as Sellers as it was for Ashby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just an incredibly touching piece. And if you see Being There, and you follow it up with something like Forrest Gump, which I don't hate on Forrest Gump. I think it's a very effective, touching movie. I know some film fans almost snobbily dismiss Forrest Gump, and I think part of that is just a snobbery over something that's been that popular.
Right. Yeah, that has a lot to do with it.
But you do sense the criticisms about Forrest Gump, you sense how they apply once you watch Being There.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the manipulative nature of Forrest Gump, which, by the way, I'll say again, I love.
No, I mean, that's only one part of Forrest Gump, really.
Yeah.
Like that. I mean, it's not Being There. So let's be very, I don't think anyone is ever going to confuse Winston Groom and Jerzy Kaczynski. Writers behind these books. I just don't. Jerzy Kaczynski was insane. He committed suicide. His books were nightmarish, to say the least, if you've ever read The Painted Bird, and then you read Being There. Being There is really just a, you know, you always think of Being There whenever you, if you watch MSNBC or any public affairs, these shows every night, you think of, and you watch them for a couple hours, and go back and watch Being There, and he, I mean, Kaczynski was making fun of all these guys, the whole Washington establishment for, you know, we hear back in the 70s, so very fascinating stuff.
And at its basic level, it's about a simpleton that kind of rises up in the political ranks.
And you can,
and
you
he's
can
taken as a
want.
Prophet.
Yeah. You use the word, very interesting you use the word simpleton, because you used it to describe Bush when we were talking about Oliver Stone's W. That's very...
Right. Well, that's just what Nick was talking about. He was talking about how, with this last administration, they were using Being There.
Yeah.
In that fashion, in some circles.
I would not have used that the way they're using that. Could backfire on them horribly.
But with Being There, it's very funny. It's very moving. And at the end, I think it's one of the great closing shots in history of movies.
Yes, it is.
Because it completely, talk about jaw-dropping. It makes you review the movie. It makes you kind of rediscover the movie and think about it in a whole different way.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
The tone of the movie, it's not played for knee-slapping comedy. It's kind of meditative in a way.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as you say, it was for Peter Sellers, because the Pink Panther movies, obviously, I mean, very funny movies, and especially when they're done with any scenes that he had with Herbert Lom were just brilliant.
Manic. He can be manic.
Manic, but here is something we hadn't seen from Peter Sellers in a very long time.
Yeah.
It had been a long time since he was in a role like this, and it was, you know, just mesmerizing to watch. And there's another case where, you know, he was a genius, and I'll never forget the day he died. When that news was announced, it was heartbreaking. Because we grew up with him, watched all the Doctor Strangelove, all those films, and it was just like, wow.
Yeah, a genius, and Ashby brought out a very special quality in the man towards the end of his career. And the clip is on YouTube. The clip of Mr. Sellers nominated alongside De Niro that year for Raging Bull. And that last clip of Sellers at the Oscars being recognized for Being There. It's incredible. So Hal Ashby was one of the best, and we're very much looking forward to this previously unseen cut of his film, Looking to Get Out, the way he intended it to be seen. This is a real find, and in the coming weeks, I'll be coming back on, and I'll give you a complete review of the film.
Okay, great.
And so you guys can put your orders in for the DVD once that releases on June 30th, and put your order in for the biography, Being Hal Ashby, Life of a Hollywood Rebel, from Nick Dawson. It's a great one, and a very deserving subject. And a great writer to bring his life and his career back to life for us. Jerry, this has been a pleasure.
It has been. It's been a lot of fun.
This is one of those shows where I'm glad to be doing what we're doing.
Yes, exactly. Oh, I couldn't agree more.
It's an honor. We'll be back Sunday. Sunday night, we have Bobby Osteen, who is the author of a new book on editing called The Invisible Cut. She's an editor in her own right, a very accomplished one, and her husband was one of the all-time great editors, edited things like Chinatown. We mentioned Chinatown earlier. The Graduate. Yeah, yeah. And she'll be with us, and we'll have recaps on the South by Southwest Film Festival that's just now dying down, I believe, this weekend.
Yeah.
And this is a fun interview. There's a movie there called Best Worst Movie. It's about, there was a film called Troll 2. It had nothing to do with the first Troll. They just thought they'd make more money if they renamed it Troll 2. It is one of the worst movies of all time. But it has such a following. People, it's almost like a Rocky Horror experience. They watch it and they clap and they revive the lines and they just have a great time with it. And it's formed this worldwide community around it of film fans. And the participants of that original film, Troll 2, one of them decided to make a documentary about this phenomenon and include all of his castmates. And four of those castmates will be on our show Sunday
and it's a great roundtable discussion about just average, ordinary people that took a chance and said, yeah, doing a movie, that sounds cool, in the early 80s, and now they're part of something so much bigger. Those are the stories I love. They're still shaking their head like, this is insane. And the next Wednesday, we have our special two-hour show on the Sarasota Film Festival 2 days before it begins, headlined by none other than Joey Pants. Joey Pants is coming back to the show, talking about a very special project to him, his documentary that he's put together on mental illness and clinical depression. It's a very revealing conversation that we have with Joey next week, so look forward to that. And then we'll be off for about 2 weeks. Do you believe that? And we'll welcome John Debney when we come back, the kind of The Passion of the Christ, which is one of the best-selling musical scores ever. And he has a new project. Guess what the new project is?
The Hannah Montana movie.
You got it. So we're going to cover
only
Hannah.
I know that because you told me.
We're going to cover Hannah Montana. Ashby and Hannah Montana. I mean, come on, guys.
You can't do better than that, or I don't know. Just remember, Larry David was a guest star on the Hannah Montana show. He played some girl's father. I'll never forget someone showed that to me on YouTube. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me.
That automatically gives Hannah Montana cred. So. And we're trying to book some other guests for the Sarasota show, and they could be very big guests. So please look out for the announcements, because this could be some exciting news coming up. But as it stands, we have 5 or 6 guests speaking about their projects next Wednesday, and there's some very, very interesting documentaries, interesting narrative work that you will be hearing about throughout the year, but just remember that you heard about it first here on Movie Geeks United.
That's right.
That's right, buddy. All right, my friend. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a wonderful, wonderful evening.
Yeah, I had a great time. And thank you, everyone out there, for listening and supporting Movie Geeks United. We appreciate your support very much, and we're signing off.
All right, good night.
Good night, everybody. Bye-bye. Thank you.